Welcome to Open Mind UFO Radio. I am Alejandro Rojas, and we've been gone for a while for a number of reasons. We're traveling, went to New York. You might have seen us on the Huffington Post, and then I was sick, too. You can kind of tell my voice. I'm not all the way back. In fact, in the interview, you'll be able to tell, hopefully not too much, that I've kind of got some low energy there, so... But we have a great guest today, but before I introduce who the guest is, I'm going to introduce who's on the line with me now. As always, the super duper, Jason McClellan. Hello, Jason.
Hey, I am super duper Jason McClellan here, ready to rock and roll.
Sweet. Well, yep, Jason was with me in New York, so that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, we got into some trouble.
Yep, not really. We're
no, not really, but we did have a good time on HuffPost Live. It was great of those guys to have us on.
So if you guys haven't seen that, you can see that online. We talked about a lot of stuff, including we were there to see my appearance with Travis Walton on The Kardashians.
That's right.
So, and that was a lot of fun. They're pretty awesome. But you can also watch a video on our YouTube about our whole experience there, and I thought it was awesome. And some people are like, oh, could you go on TV with the Kardashians? But it's like, why not? They're super cool. They're into UFOs. Definitely do it. And it was a lot of fun. The guest for today is James Carman. And he did a documentary called The Hidden Hand. In fact, it won an EBE at the International UFO Congress Film Festival in 2011 for the best documentary. So it's pretty good. People at our conference obviously liked it. And we're talking to him because it's kind of got this resurgence. It's getting distributed out there, so it's on a lot of the online media. So like Hulu and some of these other download places you can download. It's not on Netflix yet, but he says it will be soon. So we'll talk to him about that also. So it's really cool, really exciting. So we're going to talk to him about, you know, what's going on with his film and the distribution and how that's going, how that came about to help out other people in this field. Because often, you know, people make documentaries and on UFOs and they're great. They're well produced. They show at the EBE Awards and, you know, they sell at our conference and at different places. But then they don't really get it to the mainstream. So he'll tell us how he got there to hopefully help other films in this field. And let me remind you too, if you're a filmmaker and you've made a documentary on UFOs, get a hold of us. Go to the iufoc.com because we are now taking applicants for the 2014 Film Festival, which is coming up really quick here.
Yeah, speaking of the Congress, ufocongress.com, that's where all the information is. And Alejandro, this is exciting to some and terrifying for us, but we are less than 3 months away from the 2014 International UFO Congress.
Yeah, I think it's exciting, though. I mean, it's kind of fun, you know, and keeps us busy. But,
oh, it's so exciting, yeah.
So, and I know it's exciting for a lot of people. In fact, like rooms at the hotel are going really quick, so you got to get those. You've got to register really quick because everything is going at this point.
And if you haven't been to UFOCongress.com lately, do check it out. We've got a full lineup of speakers there that has just been updated recently.
Yeah.
Some exciting people on there, Alejandro. So.
Yeah, I'll talk more about it at the end of the show, too.
Excellent.
Tell people about who's going to be there. So that's our guest for in a minute. But before we talk about that, let us talk about the news. So Jason and I, of course, always choose our favorite news story from the past week, although it's been a couple weeks, so it might be from the past couple weeks. I don't know which one Jason's going to talk about. Which is it, Jay?
It's a mystery. Well, Alejandro, you know I love to talk about Mr. Robert Bigelow.
Oh, yeah.
The always fascinating Robert Bigelow. So Bigelow was in the news again last week. He was speaking at a press conference to talk about the progress that's been made with projects that Bigelow Aerospace is currently involved in their partnership with NASA. Just this year, they have agreements with NASA to do a couple things. You know, they're going to test out one of Bigelow's inflatable modules on the International Space Station, but they've also got plans to develop a lunar base. So they had a press conference talking about that, but then Robert Bigelow decided to discuss private space companies and the projects that are underway and some of the setbacks that currently exist and are hindering companies from getting involved in things like lunar exploration and this huge boom of space mining that a lot of companies are getting ready to do. And he pointed out that with current space law as it is right now, these private companies can't own property on bodies like the moon. So he is asking, and he directed this question or request to the FAA, asking for permission for private companies to own property on the moon. Now, space law is a very complex issue. It's kind of like the Wild West. There does exist some space law, but it's highly debated, and it's very vague. Right now, the 1967 Treaty on Principles Governing the Activities of Space in the Exploration and Use of Outer Space, including the Moon and Other Celestial Bodies, that's the long title for what's known as the Outer Space Treaty. It was written in 1967, and that's really the basis for space laws that exist today. Back then, when this treaty was written, a lot of the things in there that were addressed were viewed as science fiction and so far from reality that they weren't necessarily thought out as well as they should be, or thought that they would really be things that would ever have to be addressed. But this is all becoming reality right now, and there is a need for space law and these treaties to be revisited, because you have companies, and as Bigelow points out, there's for private companies putting all the money and resources into these projects, bases on the moon and things like that, it's not worth the risk involved for them to take on these projects if they're not going to be able to get anything out of it, if they're not going to be able to make money. So he's talking about being able to mine on the moon and building the structures there to do that. He says the companies need to be able to own those pieces of land to do that and get the resources and then sell them and make money. So I'm glad to see that Robert Bigelow, at least somebody needs to lead the charge in pushing for the Outer Space Treaty to be revisited, for space law to be revised, because this is something that we really are having to deal with very soon. There are so many of these companies, especially mining, that's such a gray area. Do these companies really have the legal right to mine asteroids, planets, celestial bodies, and then sell what they mine for a profit? Who does that stuff really belong to? And these are very vague questions that people fight back and forth and interpret in different ways. So there needs to be a lot of cleaning up with space law and really defining these issues that we're faced with right now.
Right. Well, and it makes sense that we're ready. We're to that point where, Bigelow's really ready to put like a little space hotel,
right,
a little inflatable device on the moon. So if he does that, where is he going to do it? And what's the legality around the property that he puts it on?
Exactly. And, we talked about this in the April-May 2013 issue of Open Minds magazine, a whole article about space law and some of the issues that these companies are going to face, like Mars One. They've got the plan to start a colony on Mars, and they've got these habitats, this whole colony that's going to be assembled by these rovers and, physical buildings. But then there's a question of do they actually own the land? Do they even own the they'll own the things that they're putting on the moon for or on Mars for people to live in, for the food to grow and stuff like that. But if you read into the Outer Space Treaty, there are parts in there that talk about any structure that's put on these celestial bodies, they're required to be open to absolutely anybody. So by those rules in the treaty, then that means that these Mars One habitats, if somebody from Russia, let's say, happened to, or China, happened to land on Mars and wanted to stroll in and hang out for a while, I guess, then by the treaty, they should be allowed to do that because these structures put on these celestial bodies belong to everybody and are open for the free use of exploration.
Well, I think what's interesting about that, too, is, you know, Bigelow was heading the tackle to open up the laws. For instance, since he's an American company, foreign nationals of other foreign countries, especially those that aren't necessarily friendly with us, cannot interact with his technology because they may glean that technology and take it back to their countries. So what are the ramifications in this case? Because if you do, let's say you have a Chinese facility right down the street from Bigelow's, they can kind of go back and forth and interact with the technology and learn from it. And it's something that we got to start thinking of.
Right. And Bigelow specifically said that he's in an interview with CNBC. He's specifically worried about China and what China might do if they, you know, get to the moon first, and what they might do if they take up all the land, and, you know, treaty or no treaty, revising space laws, this is all stuff that might happen. And that's another issue with space law as it exists now. You know, at least as far as we are aware, you know, there's not really much anybody can do to enforce space law.
Yeah.
You know, they can reprimand them down here on Earth. They can deny launch capabilities, not approve certain missions, things like that. But, you know, if some militaristic country wants to go and, you know, militarize the moon, they're going to do it. And there's not much that anybody can do to stop them right now, unless we do actually have spaceships up there that have the capability to have war in space. But who knows? But it is the Wild West right now, and people are just kind of making it up as they go. And a lot of these mining companies, too, are just operating under the assumption that, hey, we've got the technology. We're paying for these missions. We can go up and mine these asteroids and take those resources and sell them and make money. But there are a lot of people reading the existing space law and the Outer Space Treaty saying, hold on just a second. It's not that clear.
So. Yeah, and for now, they may be able to just go up there and do it. Who's going to stop them?
Exactly.
Yeah, pretty cool. Pretty crazy stuff. Crazy stuff.
But good old Bob Bigelow. Yeah, he's a mover and shaker in the new space race in this modern space age we live in. So it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, and especially, you know, whenever we post a story on him, everybody's suspecting that he's trying to take over the world or something.
That's right. That evil Mr. Bigelow.
All right. All right. Well, thank you, Jason. The story,
yes, sir.
My story, we've got a lot of good stories. We have some videos up, some crop circle stories, and a lot of good sightings. But I think the sighting that I like the most is this one in Australia. It's in a town called Belmont. It's actually in kind of the Newcastle area in Australia, where people have been seeing some weird things. In fact, one night, you know, this couple got a picture of some strange lights, and it's like a bank of white lights, but they said for the most part what they had seen was one bright blue light that had turned red and then blue again, and it was just flying in a strange way, and they had lost track of it. What's funny about this is this was covered by the Newcastle Herald, and it turns out that one of their journalists had also seen the same thing, and he pretty much described the exact same thing, that this blue light that had turned red and then back to blue, and it had flown off into the sky. And what's even cooler is then when they posted this story, I guess the Herald did a little more research, and they found a video that was actually shot earlier. It was actually uploaded on October 1st, and the video, I guess, was caught in September. but it shows the exact same thing. It shows in this a very strange blue light, very bright, off on the horizon, that is just kind of sitting there for a moment before it moves off, off the screen, and the people on the video, you can hear them talking about how weird it is, and you hear this one girl say, did you see when it was red? It was red, and then it turned blue. So this seems to be something that's going on in the Newcastle area. The video, I think, is really interesting, but I think this is a really cool case, and hopefully the Newcastle Herald, the local paper that has been covering this, will keep on it and keep us updated on what might be going on there. I guess they've gone to some people to ask what they might think it is, but nobody really seems to know. It is also interesting, they did a poll with their story and about how many people had seen UFOs, and about 26% of the people who responded said they had seen a UFO. So interesting story, I think, out there in Australia.
It is interesting, and you're right, the video is what really makes it interesting. That paired with the witness testimony, I think, because just looking at the video alone, to me it looks like some things going on with the camera trying to focus on the light, and the behavior of the object seems to be very helicopter-ish, you know, like a spotlight, and you watch the video, and the light does appear blue, but periodically, you know, and it could be what they described as the changing of color, but it looks like it's just a normal colored light, and then it goes blue again. Could be the iris of the camera trying to focus on that light, causing weird things. But if the people said that they saw the blue light in the sky with their eyes, and it was changing colors to red and stuff, then that could indicate something more mysterious than a helicopter.
Yeah, and I don't think the video, personally, I don't think the video fits with the helicopter. I mean, it doesn't, it's just a clear, bright blue. There are no other blinking lights around it. It's not blinking. I guess movement-wise, it could fit with a helicopter because it hovers and then moves to the right off-screen.
Mm-hmm.
So movement-wise, it could. But, yeah, pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's an interesting video.
Yep, pretty cool stuff. So there's one other piece of news that I want to talk about, this new press release that came out this morning, at least that's when I saw it, about some new TV show called Uncovering Aliens that's going to be on the Discovery Channel. Have you heard about this?
I've heard about this.
Yeah.
But only recently, because they just announced it.
Yeah, and it looks like, I'm looking at the picture, and it looks like that girl that sits next to us, in between us, in fact, Maureen Ellsbury's going to be on the show.
Oh, yeah, Maureen's awesome. I like Maureen.
Yeah, she's cool, so she ought to be... Oh, it's going to be on Animal Planet.
Animal Planet, that's right.
It's the Discovery Web, so Discovery must own Animal Planet.
Yes, they do.
They own everything now?
Pretty much.
Everything science on TV?
I guess they own Maureen now, too, so...
Yeah, they own Maureen. So this is kind of cool. It's going to be with Mike Farah, Daryl Sims, who we've interviewed. We've got an interview up there. You guys can Google and find some stuff on Daryl Sims on our program. And another guy, Steve Jones, I guess, who is an abductee from the UK or something like that.
Who's Mike Farah?
Mike Farah is...
I'm kidding. I know Mike. Just giving him a hard time.
Yeah, yeah. And he worked with Hoagland, right, at first, and wrote a book on the moon and stuff like that. So... Yeah, it ought to be an interesting show as Maureen takes the crew to go uncover aliens.
I can't wait to see what they uncover about aliens.
And hopefully it'll be aired sometime next month, and I guess they don't have the details on when it's going to be aired. But coming soon, Maureen on TV.
Yep, we will definitely report absolutely everything we hear about that. So
I wonder if the Kardashians are going to be on that show.
Well... always possible.
Yeah, that'd be cool. All right. Well, thank you, Jason, so much for joining us once again on Open Mind UFO Radio.
Yes, sir. It's always my pleasure.
But without further ado, let us talk to Mr. James Carman. I am excited to have with me on the phone the man who produced a very popular documentary. Hopefully some of you have seen it. If not, you'll have to go check it out. It's called The Hidden Hand. And it won an EBE Film Festival Award for Best UFO Feature Film in 2011. I have with me James Carman. Hello, James.
Hey, Alejandro. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. I haven't seen you in I guess since 2011, so it's nice to catch up with you again.
Right, yeah, it has been a while, so it's good to talk to you, and you have been busy. A lot of times, you know, some people will they'll win an award, and you don't hear much from about their production any longer, but you've been really busy, and you've been making a lot of news lately with all the different places you've gotten your documentary to be played.
Yeah, it's been nice. You know, when I screened it at the International UFO Congress, it was when you see a film projected large, it's a different experience, and then you have a different relationship to it. And then I even though I liked the film, I said, well, you know, I could tweak this just a little bit. And so I made some changes, and then my lawyer wanted me to make some changes. And then after I finished all that, then it took a while to find distribution, and now it's been out since September, and I'm very happy about that. And it seems like there's a lot of people that are enjoying it.
Mm-hmm. And by your lawyer making changes, like what kind of changes was he looking at? Was it more around copyright of images or something like that?
Yeah, and music and just some corporate logos he said he didn't want me to use, stuff like that. It wasn't major, but it took a little bit of work.
Right. I don't think a lot of people realize that either, that and it's something that we have to worry about with a magazine. You've got to have permission for all of those different images and logos or whatever that you're using.
Yeah.
And so that's got to be kind of difficult to hunt all that down.
Well, it just takes a little bit of time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of it can come under fair use, but I did as much as I could in terms of getting permission and talking to people. And it takes a little bit of while. I just wanted to do it as professionally as possible.
Mm-hmm. So you tackled a lot of topics in your documentary related to UFOs and alien abductions. But what originally got you, what is your background and what got you interested in this?
Well, I'm a filmmaker and a cinematographer and a producer also. And so that's kind of what I've done most of my adult life. And I lived in Europe for quite a while. And then when I came back here, I was producing DVDs for a healer. And I noticed that there were some women during the break that would be crying or upset. And I would overhear them talking about a pregnancy that had gone missing or having hybrid children. And I found it to be pretty bizarre, and I just kind of filed it away and said, okay, well, I don't have to deal with this right now. But then I also started meeting people that said that they had been trained as psychics and with the government or the secret government. And so I said, well, you know, I have some access here. Why don't I do something with that? And so then I that's how I began the project. I first started with Al Bielek, but then I didn't use those scenes because I shot them in a narrative manner, and I thought if I'm going to make a documentary on this subject, it has to be as straight as possible.
Mm-hmm. And when you talked about, you know, meeting these other people with these other programs in the government, did you find all of that to be credible?
You know, some of it I don't know. I can't say. Some, if you like, Ingo Swann, he was a good friend of mine. I think he's very credible.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were other people that were associated with the Montauk Project, and I can't say for sure. I just know that in their own way, they're very brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think they're lying, but it maybe something else is going on. But it quirked my interest, to say that. That's one of the impetuses that kind of started me along this path.
Mm-hmm. Now, was this project, I mean, sometimes people kind of go into things like this, well, often in this field, with a set idea of kind of what's going on and what they're going to present. Or was this like that for you, or were you kind of learning along the way?
I think I was learning along the way. Like I told you, I kind of wanted to make a more of an artsy film with narrative segments and to be yeah, kind of like a mix between a narrative film and a documentary film. And after 2 years, even longer, I gave up on that. It took me a while to give up on that. But I learned along the way. Then as I kept going, I just felt like, okay, that's not really proper to put in there. That's not proper to put in there. And in the film, I'm not saying that I know what's going on and this is the way it is. I'm basically saying this is what people are saying. I wanted to give an overview of kind of the whole ET phenomenon and what goes on and what people say. But in no way do I say that I know what's going on necessarily. It's more like a reporter exploring this terrain and then reporting what he's found.
Right. So one of the questions you ask, for example, on the DVD is preoccupation with ETs a form of cultural madness, or is something really going on? It's more of your position than to present information to people and let them determine that themselves.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, what you choose to present is always, you know, that's my slant on things. There's nothing that's wholly objective, but I do want the viewer to make their own decisions.
Mm-hmm. And going down this journey, I mean, do you feel like you have learned?
Well, I think one, it's very complicated. It's very multifaceted. I think I have learned that, you know, there is a lot to this phenomenon, and there's many sides to it, and you know, it's so deep, it's so complex, but there is definitely something to it in terms of contact, in terms of government interaction, in terms of reverse engineering of technology. That seems all very, very likely to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's maybe take each topic and kind of find out what impressions you're left with each of these. So, for example, with alien abduction, what do you find, I mean, what has piqued your interest about alien abduction, and do you feel that from what your interviews that you've been able to demonstrate that something is going on there?
Well, I think just the sheer numbers of people that say they've had this experience, and a lot of them have had them consciously. They've not all been regressed. You see that there's something to it, and there is a very much a similarity to the stories. And, you know, these stories, they happen everywhere. You know, if it's in Africa, Credo Mutwa, when he was in the 40s, he was having similar abduction experiences as, you know, Betty and Barney Hill or Jim Sparks. So it's a worldwide phenomena, and people have corroborated it independently of each other. And on the other hand, people have also had positive contact experiences, and they've corroborated these also independently. So I think there probably are different species coming here and interacting. And two, it has to do with how the experiencer interprets the experience. Some might put a negative overlay on it, and some might put a positive overlay on it, but I wouldn't say exclusively. I mean, it just depends really what happened. If someone takes you in the middle of the night and operates on you and, you know, sexually violates you, it's hard to put a positive overlay on that, in my opinion.
Right. Right, yeah. And then, like you said, there are those two camps of the positive or the negative. What would you describe as, you know, in your interviews, kind of the core experience people have had, you know, all the way back from Credo Mutwa, like you said, to current people sharing their experiences?
Well, I think one of the core things is that the veracity of it hits them like a ton of bricks. I think that's interesting. It's like, because most times people are taken, it can be any time during the day, in a car, at night from their bed, you know, while they're on a walk, you know, also with multiple witnesses seeing that these people being taken, and like in the case of Travis Walton. And, you know, they're experimented on. There's tests being done. Sometimes sperm or ova are taken. Sometimes there's training that's undergone. Sometimes they're educated about the environment, the fate of humanity, the world's kind of coming catastrophes. And usually then their brain's memories are wiped to where they have no recollection of what happened, or a false memory is inserted, and then they're put back where they came from. But sometimes they're put in the wrong house, sometimes in with someone else's clothes. There's all kinds of mishaps that happen in terms of when people are returned.
Mm-hmm. Did you interview people that had experienced like these mishaps, like being returned in the wrong place or something like that?
Yes, I did. There were quite a few. I mean, I talked to Whitley Strieber. I thought he was really good. Jim Sparks, I loved him. And then I had a friend of mine, who had positive experiences. He's really great. His name is Mark Brinkerhoff.
Mm-hmm.
And he's someone who's excuse me, who's photographed and videotaped UFOs, you know, since the 60s. So he's fun to be around with. Antonio Urzi, who you know, is like he was spending some time with me in New York, and he would just say in the morning we'd be going out, and he would just say 4:30, and then when we would when 4:30 would roll around, he would just pull out his camera and start shooting, and lo and behold, then there would be like two objects up in the sky.
Oh, really? That you witnessed also?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, that's really interesting.
It's interesting because when you see that someone's connected and they know it's going to happen, that I find pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned some people there, you know, some who felt they had negative experiences, your friend who had positive experiences.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of that? Do you feel kind of like you said earlier, it's their interpretation or the interactions themselves just different?
I think the interactions are different. I'm not saying that there are some people who think that they have had positive contact and really haven't, that that's an overlay, or that there are some people that have had negative experiences and they've overreacted possibly. But I have noticed in some of the abductees that there seems to be more post-traumatic stress symptoms than like the positive contactees.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting to note because even if your memories are wiped, still that experience is there and still it's going to affect your whole life and the whole trajectory of your life and how you interact with people, especially since most of these interactions start when people are very young children. And you know how impressionable children are, and if you're taken away from your family, you don't know if you're ever going to be returned home. You know, you're in this extremely strange environment that you don't really know how to understand. I think it could have lasting effects.
Mm-hmm. You also tackled the feeling that some people have that there's a human-alien hybridization type of program going on.
Mm-hmm.
Were you aware of, like, the reports of this sort of thing before you started shooting the documentary?
Only when I told you that when I first was doing that, I was producing that Healing DVD series, and
mm-hmm.
then I heard of it from the women in the class that obviously were there, they're interested in healing. And so that, when I initially heard of it, I thought it was totally bizarre. And then
when I
started thinking about it more, it kind of affected me in a very visceral way.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like we've been ingrained to think of ourselves as the top dog here on Earth, right? And that we can do whatever we want and we're basically the stewards. And then the idea to think that, well, maybe we aren't, you know, the top rung on the evolutionary order. And maybe that there's people who are doing to us what we do to animals, say, that's a very unsettling thing. And you know, there's something about the human species. You know, if you have a love for the human species, you want us to survive, you want us to thrive, you want us to evolve. And then when you think about that whole process that, you know, is for me is sacred, that it being hijacked by someone else, that's a very visceral ideal, that's an unsettling.
Right. And who were some of the people you interviewed that you felt really lent a lot of credibility to the possibility of this really going on?
Well, Niara Isley, I think, is one that I really liked. She was a radar operator at Tipona in Nevada, and you know, she had experiences in her life where she's been a contactee or an experiencer for all of her life. Since she was 4, she has memories. And she always felt that she was made to be very sexual. And she said that she's been used as a breeder, you know, ever since she started having her period. And this went on until her 30s, but it's still, this contact still goes on. But so I think she was credible. I mean, you can tell that she's been under stress, and this has been very stressful for her, but I find her to be a credible person.
Mm-hmm. And does she have an idea about why this is happening?
Well, she's coming out with a book now, so I should ask her again. I don't really... She didn't really talk about that much. She was talking about how she had all these babies were created by one hybrid. She had a relationship with one hybrid that was there, you know, for most of her adult life, and she would always have sexual intercourse with him, and the babies came from him. And it was more like a job that they both had to do. It wasn't necessarily that they neither one of them wanted to do it. And she said that there was some kind of emotional connection, but it was more the bond of, you know, both being in a place where you didn't necessarily want to be.
Uh-huh. Well, what about you and your interviews? Have you come up with at least your feeling or some different ideas on why that's going on?
I could give you a couple scenarios. One is if the grays, well, there's hybridizations going on with supposedly grays and with reptilians. I haven't heard about it so much with the Nordics, but I'm sure that could be a possibility, but I don't know why they would want to interbreed with us. It's more like if you have a race and you've cloned yourself so many times and your gene pool has become limited, and perhaps in the distant past there was a catastrophe and you had to change your whole lifestyle, maybe live underground or move to another planet, and you see your genetic trajectory is not going to survive, then you have to look for ways to bring in genetics that are somehow related to yours or that could work, and then start another race. I mean, that would be the only survival. Your race would die, but at least that hybrid race would be able to survive. And I think that's fairly plausible. You know, there's also talk that if we actually destruct and we don't manage to survive as a civilization here on Earth, then there would be other beings to repopulate the Earth. That may be true. I mean, they seem to be concerned with the environment and very much concerned with nuclear energy and nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. Do you have some of the interviews that kind of along those lines as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, people, I mean, a lot of abductees are shown scenarios of nuclear destruction. And, yeah, I think that it is a concern. And a lot of them shown images of the Earth being even more polluted than it is now and being very hard for humanity to continue to live the way we are living now. We take everything for granted, but food could very easily be a lot harder to grow, and it could be a lot less healthy for us to eat.
Mm-hmm. Now, your cover, you have like this picture of a military guy getting into kind of some of the military stuff that you get into. And he's got, you know, half an alien face, half of a human face. What were you representing in that picture?
Well, what I'm representing is the fact that in terms of the hidden hand, that means that there's a powerful group that is manipulating human events and human history from behind the scenes that we haven't been told of, that we have no privy to this information. And whether you want to call it the secret government or these black rogue groups, you know, there is a lot of evidence that that's happening, especially if we look at what the NSA has been up to, and that's probably just a little bit of what they've been doing for the last 60 years. You can imagine that there is a lot of control going on in the background that's not talked about in a democratic sense. And I think that most of our elected officials have no idea and are not even allowed to know about these things because they don't have a need to know in terms of national security. And then on the other hand, you have ET, which is obviously interacting with humanity and has been for thousands of years. And, you know, if you have someone this powerful and this advanced interacting with your species, then obviously it's going to be a big influence on us. And I think that that is important because they don't want us to know what they're up to. Usually they wipe people's memories. We have the barest accounts and barest facts that to go on. We just know something's going on, but we don't really know what or why. And we know it's very important because you can imagine if you have all these scout ships and all these motherships and all these machineries and interactions built for interacting with humans and taking them on board, having processes, having training, and then most people, their memories wiped and they're put back. It's a very, very important project for ET, and we don't know why. And so, that's a hidden hand that's manipulating human events and history.
Mm-hmm. Do you think those two hidden hands are working together?
You know, I can't say. I think it's likely. If you look at the history of the Earth, in terms of many people say that we've been created or we were a hybrid from a hominid that was initially thriving here, and then ET that came in terms of needing other workers to complete their gold mining projects. I mean, this was talked about in many mythologies and many histories, and that Adamic man was created to work for the gods that were here. And then for some reason or another, the gods left right before the flood. And then kind of humanity was left to piece it back together and start civilization over again. So, I mean, I don't know what the interface is or if there still is one between the ETs from those times and what's going on now. But I'm sure at some level there is some kind of interface, but I don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what's hard to say, huh?
Yeah.
See, you got a couple of really interesting interviews, too. I mean, one of them, for instance, is with Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Was that difficult to get that interview? How did that come about?
Well, I was in Washington for the X conference, and, you know, I was there with Rich Dolan, and I said, hey, Rich, can you ask Edgar for me? And he said, okay. And then I did. And then he said, okay, as long as it doesn't take too long. And I said, okay, I'll be quick. Let's do it. So it worked out pretty well, I thought.
Yeah, perfect. Were you able to learn something new from the talk with him?
Well, I mean, I think his story, I wasn't totally aware of it. I mean, in terms of, I didn't know that he grew up in Roswell, New Mexico. And so he has a very intimate relationship with all the old-timers there that actually experienced the Roswell crash and the debris from the crash, and also some that said that there were beings that were found in that crash. So I think that's fascinating. And then they come to him, obviously, because he's someone that's well-respected and someone that isn't going to threaten them, like other authority came to them and threatened them and said, if you speak, you know, it's going to be problems for you and your family. So I found that amazing. And he said he went to the Pentagon and corroborated these stories. So, I mean, he's a very, very credible man in my opinion. And I think that adds a lot of weight to the story.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to feedback to your documentary, what are some of the parts or what are some of the interviews people ask you about or seem to be most shocked by?
Well, most people ask me about Edgar Mitchell. They really love Edgar Mitchell. They love talking about Paul Hellyer, too. People like talking about Whitley Strieber. And, you know, exopolitics, I think, is a very interesting question, topic to talk about, because it's kind of humanity on a political level. I'm kind of reaching back. And right now, this hasn't brought any real fruition in terms of establishing like a codified formal relationship with ET or non-human species, but I think it's an important step. So we talk about that. And, you know,
and what would your definition, I mean, what's your idea of what exopolitics is?
My idea is that it's, you know, like what the word says, exo, beyond or outside of politics of the human realm. So it has to do with setting up formalized government institutions to interact with ET in a way that's public and not hidden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just curious about your definition, because a lot of people in that arena, which is a term we haven't heard a lot of recently, it doesn't seem like, have different definitions. So I was just curious of your impression of that.
What do other people say?
Just some of talk about it more along the lines of study, or but I think, you know, what you're defining is what most people see it as.
Right.
But yeah, some definitions get a little longer and a little more detailed, but just curious, just to set that, you know, what you had thought that was about.
And no, so it definitely could be more detailed.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I think we should start smaller rather than larger. I mean, I think it's pretty amazing that, you know, the UN in Vienna, they have a group that already considers this idea, or they consider the idea of extraterrestrial life, maybe in terms of only microbes and stuff so far, but it is a start.
Right, right. So people kind of talk about, do it, people tell you, you know, something that they're particularly shocked about when they look at your DVD, maybe something that they weren't aware of before?
I think most of people are shocked about the idea that, let's say, rogue elements of our military could be abducting people on a regular basis in terms of to debrief abductees or experiencers so they can find out more information about ET. I think a lot of people find that shocking and, yeah, maybe don't want to believe that. Obviously, I think there's quite a few people who think the whole idea of a human alien hybrid race to be somewhat fantastic, and it is somewhat fantastic, but I mean, the thing is if it's something that you're hearing over and over again from a lot of different sides, then I think it's worth reporting on and then at least putting it out there rather than just saying, okay, this is too weird, let's drop this.
Right, which is good. I mean, to be brave and to, like, you know, be complete in representing what people are saying out there.
Yeah.
And you certainly have a large gamut. I mean, you have people from the side that are very positive about everything going on, and you have people that you interview that are from the side that are very negative about everything going on.
Right. Like Nassim Harman, I think he's great. I mean, he's kind of wonderful. He's he's had contact experiences very positive, and he thinks the whole negative stuff is nonsense. It's more like people misinterpret it, I think, and kind of blow it out of proportion. But then you have people like Dr. Jacobs, who's been studying this, I don't know, for 40 years, and, you know, he's certainly not a fool, and he's also a very respectable man.
Mm-hmm. Do you come down more closer on one side than the other?
You know, I can't say for sure. It's because it seems like I would say it's the other, more into it's not black and white. It's just all this gray or variations of gray, and it's probably very complex, and it's probably not just one race. So I think it's very deep and very buried. So I don't think it makes sense to say, all Europeans are bad, but all Africans are good. You know,
right.
That's kind of a very simple-minded approach to things.
Yeah, that makes sense. So when it's come to distribution of your documentary, you've done something that is kind of novel, at least for this field, in that you've gone digital mostly, it seems, and you've been pretty successful in it. And, of course, a lot of these places you've gone to are fairly new as far as, you know, distributing documentaries at all. But could you describe how that came about in some of those places that you are digitally distributed and how that's been going?
Yeah, well, see, you know, I came more from a film world, so I said, okay, well, I'll send to film festivals, and then you start realizing how the straight consensus reality world isn't really that open to this at all, you know. And if you don't get outright disregarded, oftentimes you get mocked and ridiculed, and it's not as bad as it used to be, but that's still the case of not being taken seriously. So then I started shifting and saying, okay, well, I'll send to kind of more alternative film festivals. And in truth, I didn't really need to do that, but it was since I come from that background, that's what I wanted to do. And I went to many distributors in that kind of straight film world, and most of them, you know, didn't take it seriously at all. It's just not something they would look at. They didn't want to represent something like that. And then, you know, after, God, a year, at least a year of looking around, I found a distributor that was pretty big and said, yeah, sure, we can do this. And so I started working with them. They're called Gravitas. And so it's just the way that they work. It's not, they bring it onto many different platforms. And since they had those contacts, then It just went out that it's now you can buy it on iTunes, you can buy it on Google Play, you can buy it on Amazon Instant, Hulu, Vudu, and Xbox, which is great, I think. You can really, a lot of people can have access to it, and it's more like getting the word out there so people know that the film is there.
Mm-hmm. And has that worked out pretty well for you?
It worked out fairly well so far. I mean, I'm hoping for more and, you know, a little bit more of a push. It's for 3 weeks, it was one of the top 10 selling documentaries on Google Play, which I think is amazing. And it was also for 1 week, one of the top 10 on iTunes. So, I mean, that's big. And I just want to kind of push that envelope and let give other people the opportunity of seeing it. You know, if they go to my website, it's hiddenhandthemovie.com, then there's information and links, and you can see what we're up to.
Right. Yeah, that's really cool. And I mean, what does that translate into numbers? Do you know?
I have no idea, because part of the agreement with them was like, okay, we'll make this deal between you and I, but then you can't mess with any of the deals we're making with other people. That's the way they work. And because otherwise, they would have to bring me as a third party in on every contract negotiation, and in their mind, that just makes it hard, and they already have these set relationships. So I'll find out in January what some of that is. you know, we'll see how what that actually means.
Yeah, because, I mean, hopefully those numbers are really high, whereas a lot of these documentaries, you know, they sell them at the UFO conferences, and, you know, maybe they sell a few hundred, if they're lucky, maybe 1,000 or 2 copies, but then that's all that gets to see them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am coming out in with DVDs in January, so that'll be fun, and then I'll be able to go. I'll go to UFO conferences again and start selling some. And it, you know, it'll also be available in bigger stores, hopefully, like you know, Target or Walmart or you know some of these other ones that like still sell DVDs, and that would be fun to see my film in actual DVD section in a mainstream store.
Right, yeah, that would be awesome. So what else are you working on now? Are you still working kind of in this realm?
I would like to make a follow-up of this film. I have tons of materials, and I would kind of like to go into it deeper. Depending on if this film does well enough, then I could actually do that. I'm doing another film. It's called Superconscious, and I'm interviewing and filming people who have special gifts and abilities, and it's kind of more like a call to inspiration to all of us to look at people who maybe are using more than the 10% of their brain, and it's kind of like a call, wake up call, that we can expand ourselves and we can evolve.
Do you think that's part of any message that may be coming, you know, that people feel they're being given from extraterrestrial sources?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think even with the negative and the positive, because obviously the positive, they're here, they're concerned about us, they want us to evolve, they want us to develop our spiritual and psychic gifts, and the negatives, if you talk to a lot of abductees over their whole life, they have the feeling like, you know, maybe it meant something, or maybe I got something out of it. A lot of them are more intuitive, and a lot of them are very artistic. And so, you know, sometimes if you put someone in a pressure cooker and you make them react to that, they'll be able to do things that they wouldn't necessarily know they could do. And so maybe in terms of humanity as a species, it's kind of this is an outside pressure that's been put on us to make us change, to make us react and grow, even though maybe we don't want to grow and we don't feel like it. So I think there's probably a lot to that.
Right. And I did want to ask one more thing, too, just to help other filmmakers out in this arena. Mm-hmm. Kind of the experiences that you had submitting to film festivals, I mean, were some of them really negative towards you? Did you have to kind of be pretty tough when you submitted to them?
Well, you know, it depends on what your level of tolerance for rejection is. Mine is pretty high. I mean, I really wanted to get in a couple of the bigger festivals that had been friends with me over the years, and or that I had contacts to, and that didn't happen. And so that kind of was hard emotionally. But then you just figure out, like, which ones are open, and then you kind of submit to those, and then you're happy when they take you. I'm showing a film of mine in the Spiritual and Visionary Film Festival in Jakarta on the 27th. And, I mean, I think that's amazing, you know, to be able to go to Jakarta and, you know, intermingle with like-minded people and say, okay, this is happening all over the world. And on the other hand, I think also like the more mainstream TV and festivals that slowly but surely they're becoming a little bit more interested in our camp. So, you know, I think people should always try shoot for the moon, swing for the fences, and then, you know, you'll probably get where you need to be.
Yeah, that's really cool. So in your view, I mean, do you think things are changing a bit? Do you see people opening up more to the topic.
Well, what's funny is that, you know, you used to just get outright dismissal. And nowadays, I said, well, I made this film on ETs. I'm showing it at this festival. Do you want to come? And they look at me like, what? Are you what? And then some of them, instead of giving me that, they'll look at me and it's like, you know, like a look of worry comes across their mind, and they go, oh no, am I really going to have to take this seriously? Am I really going to? Is this some one other thing I'm going to actually have to study and look into so I can have an opinion? So I think that's funny. It's something I've seen.
Right, and that may be a lot of it. Just, you know, people don't want to go through that effort.
Right, and it's also, you know, in terms of cognitive dissonance, it's very hard because, you know, even if we're exposed to some of this, we tend to dismiss it right away or right after a while because it doesn't fit into our reality box, and it feels much safer to say, okay, that's not in a reality box. I'm not moving. I'm not opening up nothing. You know, I'm just staying here. But then, you know, the more you kind of attack that cognitive dissonance, then it kind of allows people the space to say, okay, well, what's going on? Let's have a look.
Right. So, do you think you'll be getting on Netflix anytime soon?
I'm hoping to in spring. I mean, it's not a done deal, but it's possible. Yeah, that would be fantastic if I get on Netflix.
But until then, people can go to Xbox, they can go to Amazon, they could go to Google Play, iTunes, Vimeo, all of these places to go watch the movie.
Yeah, if you go to hiddenhandthemovie.com, then there's in the menu bar it says buy now, and it gives you all the links of places you can go. And I'll have a DVD out in January, and you'll be able to order them from me, from my site.
Awesome. Perfect. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the show and talking to me for a while, and good job. It seems like your documentary is having a lot more success than many of the great documentaries in this field, and yours is a good one, an EBE award-winning one, right?
Yes, thank you so much. I mean, I really appreciate reconnecting with you, and it was so enjoyable for me to be down at the International UFO Conference. I had a great time, and, you know, I met so many people, so I'd like to visit you all again down there.
Yeah, I hope you do. I'm sure a lot of people would like to see you again and purchase DVDs.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much, Alejandro.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Carmen. That was a lot of fun talking to him. And you got to check out his DVD. You know, everybody, like I said, his documentary, people love it. You can find out more at hiddenhandthemovie.com. Like he said, hiddenhandthemovie.com. And remember, that was an EBE award winner. And if you go to the UFO Congress, that's one of the things you can do every night is you can watch the films that have been submitted to the festival. And then when you come to the banquet on Saturday, we have our whole award ceremony where you get to see who wins. You also get to vote on if you've watched any on the People's Choice Award to tell which ones that you saw that you liked the best, and maybe your favorite will win an award. So that's one of the cool things at the International UFO Congress. Remember, that's going to be February 12th to the 16th. You can go to ufocongress.com and click on the speaker button and see all the speakers. We've got lots of cool speakers. In fact, we've got George Knapp. Oh, and that reminds me, I'm going to be on Coast to Coast this weekend with George Knapp. But George Knapp is going to be on the show. He's going to have some new information about Bob Lazar because it's the 25th anniversary since Bob Lazar has come out. And he may have some more surprises around that there. But we've got Timothy Good, of course, that many of you, I'm sure, have read his books. We're going to have George Norrie there, speaking of Coast to Coast. We've got lots of science. We've got lots of abductees. We've got Stephen Bassett. We've got Bigfoot, for those of you who are interested in Bigfoot. And, of course, as usual, we got Jaime Musan. So we've got a lot of really cool people. But you got to go register right now, ufocongress.com. I mean, it's priced like other conferences, but it's two or three times longer than most conferences, which is awesome. And the venue is nicer than any other venue I've seen any other conference in. This place is just beautiful out in the desert. So you'll definitely have a lot of fun. It's the largest conference in the world, annual conference on UFOs. So you have just tons and tons of people there to talk to. And everybody always meets new people, and they always meet new lifelong friends. So come to the Congress. Come check it out. And you better register quick before you miss out. Anyway, thank you all very much. Remember, you can go to openminds.tv for all of the news that we talked about. You can also go to our YouTube site and see Spacing Out. We have a new episode from last week talking about the news, UFO news out there that's from the website. And I also want to thank the gentleman who gave us the music for the show. And that, of course, is Caleb Hanks on the opening music and Two Earth Minutes on the close music. And I want to thank you all for listening. I know we were out for a while, and it's always a lot of fun when we have people saying, where are you? Where are you? I live for the show, and all of these great comments. And it's really always very nice and inspiring to hear that. So thank you guys very much for those comments. And sorry for the been a few weeks, but hope you enjoy the show. And we'll talk to you next week, people.